Hawkwood podcast. In July 2019, Hawkwood held its biannual Seed Festival, an environmental festival focused on planting big ideas. One of the speakers at this year's Seed was Helen Browning, organic farmer and chief executive of the Soil Association. I caught up with Helen during the festival to find out more about the report she's been working on with the RSA, how Brexit will affect British farmers, and her book, Pig, Tales from an Organic Farm.
So I'm Helen Browning. I'm chief executive of the Soil Association, and I'm also a farmer in Wiltshire, an organic farmer.
Can you tell me a little bit about your background in organic farming?
Well, I grew up on the farm I now run, and it wasn't an organic farm when I was growing up. But as I started to see all the wildlife disappearing from the farm as we ripped out the hedges and all that kind of thing to make way for the big machinery, I started to recognise that not all was well with the world. And so during my late teens and early 20s, I started to understand a little bit about organic farming and was lucky enough to be the research student on the first Ministry of Agriculture funded research programme on organic farming. So that gave me a really good opportunity to understand the techniques that I hadn't learnt while I was doing my degree in agriculture. So rotations and, companion planting, those kind of things. And that's what got me going. And when I took over the farm in 86, I decided that I wanted to go organic, tested things out on a small scale for the first year or so, partly to learn and partly to give the farm staff, who were very nervous about the idea of this young female boss who got these organic tendencies, a chance to understand what the system might look like in practice. And then we started to convert the whole of the farm.
So were they not particularly receptive at first, or you won them over?
I think that they were very nervous about, farmers get very... They lack confidence in their ability to farm without chemicals or to manage animals without routine antibiotics, because that's what they've been told. That's what I was told. That's how you had to do it. And so I think it was challenging for them, and particularly coming from somebody who was a half their age and female. That didn't help either.
And you're the chief exec of the Soil Association. Those two jobs seem like they'd be really different. How do you find managing them together?
Well, they are very different in some ways, in that one is very practically based and actually running a business and running a farm and all the other things we do there. But in some ways, they're very compatible, because I think, obviously in the Soil Association's work, we're trying to influence policymakers, we're working with farmers, we're working with everybody from school cooks to foresters, lots and lots of different stakeholders. And I think they really appreciate that there's somebody who has that practical side of their life as well. So you're not just talking theoretically, you're talking from real knowledge. And I think it helps in many ways to be able to relate to other farmers or even to politicians, to be able to say, right, this is what it actually looks like on my own farm, and to be able to take people there and show them what we do. So in a way, I think that they're two sides of the same coin. And I'm lucky because, it feels like all my life is aligned in the same direction. Albeit that there are different ways of going about it, one of them more actually doing and one of them more advocating.
When you're doing that kind of advocating work, how do you change the message when you're talking to, for example, government ministers or the general public?
Well, I think in many ways the message should be very similar. I think I'm nervous about the fact that we spin things very differently for different audiences. But I think we need to be careful about jargon. So people use jargon as a way of showing that they are part of that tribe. And so if you're with policymakers, you might need to use some of the buzzwords that they will make them understand that you understand what they understand. And when I'm with farmers, I'll talk dirty in farming language, because that's the way they will understand that I'm part of their community. And the danger is when you start talking to more public audiences to make sure you get rid of the jargon, because other people don't understand what the hell you're talking about. But I think the same core messages are the same wherever you go. You just need to make sure that they're relevant to the people you're talking to.
Can you say a little bit about what those core messages are?
Well, that's a big subject. I guess at the moment, one of the things I'm really keen to get across is that the big challenges we face, you know, climate change, the biodiversity crash, the human health crisis that we've got on our hands, need to be tackled in an integrated way. So what I am always nervous about is siloed thinking, where if we're just going to tackle climate change, we're not going to think about the impacts on biodiversity or the impacts on humans and how we feed them well, then we'll end up with some really perverse outcomes. So trying to get the message that these big challenges all need to be tackled with win-win solutions, systemic solutions. And that's why I'm a fan of organic farming, actually, because it's a systems approach, which may not be absolutely best in class against each of those criteria. There might be, you know, it might be that growing hybrid trees in very intensive circumstances might be a quicker way to mop up some carbon. But if you if by doing that you then destroy half your wildlife and you can't feed people either, then you haven't got very far down the line. So systems approach, tackling big challenges, and trying to actually get everybody, whatever their perspective, onto the same page. We need to have all the voices around the table. I've been working very hard over the last few years on this RSA, Commission on the Future of Food Farming in the Countryside, which is all about trying to bring different perspectives, all the sectors around the table, and to agree a common position so that we can make progress, because we operate too often in silos. And that way, nothing ever gets done. Or if it does get done, it doesn't get done right.
What kind of things would you most like to see both governments and farmers doing to help increase biodiversity and fight climate change?
So the commission that I've just referred to has made it clear in its report this week that we should be looking at a 10-year transition to an agroecological system. And agroecology covers a number of systems. The best researched and evidenced of them is organic, but you've also got things like permaculture and integrated pest management systems. Basically, working with nature and only using chemicals as an absolute last resort. Now, I think that's a really important place to have got to. It's a big task to make that shift for a lot of farmers, because it will require more complex farming systems. It will mean in many places bringing rotations back, bringing livestock where there are no livestock, reducing livestock numbers, perhaps where there are lots of livestock, reducing the amount of grain feeding that's going on. It's going to be a huge shift for farmers to make. But I think if we could crack that, if you take that as our goal, and then you think, okay, well, now we need to make sure that healthier, more sustainable produce is available to people easily, make it accessible so that everybody can eat well from those systems. That's the second big challenge. How do you get the food from the farms at a price that's fair to consumers and to farmers, more directly, without all the packaging, so that it's fresh and will feed people well? And those two challenges of changing our farming system and then changing our food supply system are the ones that we need to tackle now. And they're doable, but they're going to take a lot of effort.
How should we do that?
So in the report, we set out a few key steps on the farming side. So one is making sure that farmers have got a source of really good, trusted, independent advice. And that may be from other farmers who will need to be helped to share that advice, because it's not something we're automatically good at, knowing how to mentor other farmers. But at the moment, most advice that farmers get comes from people who are trying to sell them something, whether that's agrochemicals or antibiotics or whatever it might be. So we need independent, trusted advice, ideally farmer to farmer. We need research that is driven by farmers, so that they are tackling the challenges with the resources they've got on the farm, again, rather than having research done by people in white coats a million miles away who are usually just trying to sell them something. So that's going to be important. They're going to need investment. So we talk about an agroecological bank, which will fund some of those longer term systemic changes that we need to see. And we talk about more cooperation, support for farmers to collaborate and cooperate so that they have more strength in the marketplace and so that they're making better use of their resources. They're working together better, whether that's actually creating wildlife corridors or new market opportunities. So I think that's some of the stuff we need to do on the farming side. In terms of getting that food to people well and healthily, we are very critical of the way that consumers, citizens, are being sold to all the time. The marketing budgets of junk food companies are something like 200 times higher than the budgets of people who are trying to encourage people to eat more healthily. So it's a pretty tilted playing field. And so I think there need to be more constraints about marketing junk food to kids in particular. We need investment in terms of infrastructure to get food from farms to people freshly and well. So more hubs. I mean, there's some great examples in our field guide to the future. There's some great examples of where this is already happening well, but we need more of that so that that food can be less processed and less packaged and still hold its nutrition by the time people eat it. And we talk about a national nature service, the opportunity for more people to work, maybe for a gap year or for when they're changing careers in the countryside. So that they actually more people have the opportunity to connect with nature, either through working there or through making it possible for people to enjoy the countryside, actually walk and experience the benefits that nature provides. So there's lots of stuff in there. And we've also got to grow lots more nuts and fruits and vegetables and pulses, because we shouldn't be importing all this stuff. We should be producing it here. It's a long list, sorry. And there's no easy answers.
It feels like with the Soil Association, the work that you're doing is so broad, thinking about, you know, junk food and getting people more involved in nature. Is that a kind of perception you sometimes have to fight against? People think if you're the Soil Association, you're this really kind of narrow, single issue organisation.
Yes, I think people often have really very different perceptions of what the Soil Association is. I mean, you know, we're a membership charity, an educational charity. We've been around since 1946. And because we have this holistic message where actually, you know, everything is connected, soil, plant, animal, man, that was the sort of founding statement, then we need to work on lots of different fronts. So we do, we work. And sometimes we work under different brands. So we work as Food for Life, for instance, in schools and hospitals, both changing the food that's on kids' plates and making sure that is much more sustainable and healthy. We work as innovative farmers when we're supporting organic and non-organic farmers to do their own research. We work as Sustainable Food Cities in partnership with two other organisations, giving cities a framework to put food right at the heart of what they're doing within their community. So we are working very broadly. We also work with farmers on an advisory basis. And then people obviously know us as a certifier too. We have a wholly owned subsidiary which does certification using standards that we've often set within the charity. And so that is another huge chunk of our work, particularly forestry. We're certifying forests in 52 countries around the world, over 15 million hectares of forest, and not a lot of people know that. So yeah, we do loads of stuff, but it's great to have that breadth, because you know you can't change one thing. You can't change the way people farm if you don't then change the demand for that food and make sure that it can be utilised. Otherwise, farmers change and then they change back, because if they go organic and then nobody wants to buy their food, they're not going to stay organic for very long. So you need to be doing all of these things at the same time and trying to work in a quite integrated way. But it does make life quite complicated trying to make sure that you're moving all those agendas forward at the same time.
How have you seen farming change over the course of your career?
I guess when I started my farming career in the mid-80s, I think things were actually at their worst. particularly around things that I really care about, like animal welfare. And, you know, the pig and poultry units that were being set up at that time were pretty horrific. And so I think that we have seen a gradual shift in the right direction in the UK, with standards improving, particularly on things like welfare. You know, we banned sow stalls in the UK some 20 years ago. We banned veal crates before that. You know, so we have really shifted the dial. Over recent years, the the fact that we're overusing antibiotics has been recognised, and farmers have started to act on some of that stuff. So I think things have moved in the right direction, but I think that pace of change is accelerating right now. Where even 5 years ago, if I went to the east of England, the sort of area where a lot of the cereals are grown, farmers would still say, don't come and spout your organic nonsense over here. Actually, my soils are fine. I've been doing this for 30 years, this very, you know, growing without rotation, really, and nothing, there's no problem. That's all changed suddenly as the chemistry is failing, the chemicals aren't working anymore. They're getting problems with things like black grass resistance, and their soils, where the organic matter levels have gone down to 1-1.5%, really low levels, they're finding it very difficult to work their soils, and yields are plateauing or falling. So suddenly lots of farmers want to know about soils and want to know about how they can improve them. And I think that there is a much broader recognition that environment and health is as important as yield in food, in the way we farm and produce food now. So I think that farmers are much more receptive. Things have improved. And I think it's all in the balance now as to whether we will make further rapid big strides in that direction, which I think is really possible, or whether we will cock it up completely and just start to think again that it's all about lowest cost production, allowing imports in that don't meet our standards and undermining our own farming community. The trade deals we do over the next year or two are probably the most critical aspect of that, because if we don't allow substandard food in, I think farmers have got a real opportunity to drive on now and improve and really grasp the sustainability agenda well. But I think if we undermine them by allowing stuff in from the States that doesn't meet our standards here, for instance, I think we'll be in real trouble.
Leading on from that, what are your concerns about farming post-Brexit?
Well, the first one is that issue around trade. I mean, a no-deal Brexit would be really hard for farming, but it would be exacerbated then by doing the wrong trade deals. And that might sound terribly boring and rather, you know, conventional, but actually if we don't get that bit of it right, we won't be able to maintain and improve our standards still further. And then I think, you know, nobody knows what sort of support there's going to be for farming after. There's all this talk about public money for public goods, but nobody knows what that really looks like. We don't know how we're going to be, you know, what metrics we're going to be judged by. There's loads and loads of uncertainty going on, which is all about Brexit and the opportunity to repatriate our policy. We don't really know yet what the regulatory base is going to look like. We've got the Environment Bill still kind of, you know, waiting in the wings. The Agriculture Bill is still sitting there and, you know, and not yet really fully fleshed out. We still want some changes in that. So I think there's a lot to play for still. And then we've got, you know, politicians all about to move out, Gove about to possibly disappear. And who knows who will follow. So I think there's a lot to worry about. But, you know, it all does feel like it's hanging in the balance.
Are there any good things that could come?
The reason I've been keen on trying to get this commission to be involved with that is that there's a lot of potential upside. I think that there's no doubt the Common Agricultural Policy has been a constraint. It's not been as much of a constraint as our politicians would have us believe. We published a report just a few weeks ago called Green Brexit, which showed actually that many other countries are doing amazing things in terms of, you know, Denmark has a 60% organic target within public procurement, for instance, and is achieving that. You know, France has really gone down an agroecological route. So lots of other countries, even within the CAP, are doing great things. But Brexit has given us the excuse and the opportunity to relook at farming policy here. And generally, the view seems to be that we will never be the cheapest at anything, so we must be the best. You know, that's the right approach to take. We should be looking at producing healthy, great quality, low input food. So all of that could be really, really good, but we've got to see it through. There's been lots of good talk, and now we've got to make sure it turns into action.
Can you tell me a bit about Pig, the book that you wrote?
Well, Pig was a book that I wrote over 6 months, from the shortest day of 2017, 21st of December 2017, to the 21st of June 2018. And it followed a gang of pigs, seven sows and their youngsters, from birth through to the slaughter of the youngsters. The pig lives about 6 months. And so it's a real diary, really, of the lives of those pigs. And at the same time as I'm telling the story of their lives, and that meant a wonderful opportunity to go and just spend loads of time in the wind and the rain up in the pig field and get to know that gang really well. At the same time, also telling the story, the real life story of a farm, ours, at a moment of change, where we're thinking about all the things we've just talked about here in terms of the future, but also with my daughter coming into the farming business, and then reflecting too on those wider policy changes that are in play. So it's a sort of three layered book, really, with the pigs being at the heart of it, but also telling some of those wider stories about what's going on in the world, in a way that, you know, from the pig up, from the ground up.
What was it like to really get to know pigs when you'd sort of had time away from them? Was it sort of, did it all kind of come back, or did you feel weirdly disconnected from them?
Well, I always go and spend lots of time with the pigs whenever I'm at home. So I'm away during the week with the Soil Association, I get back at the weekend and I spend the weekend walking the farm and going to see all the animals and that sort of thing. But it was always pigs in general. You know, I hadn't had, go and see them all, but I wouldn't know them that well as a gang. So the different thing was actually going and really getting to know roughly 60 piglets and seven mums, and attaching to them. Actually, you know, they got to know me very well. So spending the amount of time with them where they will, they become incredibly warm and friendly. You know, I can just go and curl up with them anywhere and they'd be completely chilled about it. They almost saw me as a pig, I think, some of the time. And lots of stuff. To be honest, even when we started, I didn't ever get as close as that to any individual pigs on over that kind of stretch of time, where you almost become part of the family. It was an extraordinary experience.
One thing that you said in your talk earlier was then what it was like having to then send those pigs to be slaughtered. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yes, I mean, I think I was aware right from the start that this was going to be interesting for me. You know, we send off pigs to slaughter every week. That's what we do. And yet you never, as a farmer, I think, take that. You're never blasé about that. I remember my father, when we were drawing lambs when I was a kid, drawing lambs for the butcher on a Monday morning, saying, you know, who am I to play God today? And I think there is something about that. Looking it in the eye, actually being very aware of what you're doing and wanting to do it as well as you possibly can. And obviously, as an organic farmer, you know, I think all farmers want to make sure their animals have a good life and a good death. It was hard, but it was fine, actually, too. And I think that's what If anything surprised me, the fact was that it was still fine. And I could feel as I always have felt about it in more abstract terms. I have given these pigs a really good life. They would not have been here and had this life if I hadn't farmed them. It's been a reasonably fair deal.
It feels like a lot of consumers of meat in this country and perhaps globally just are really disconnected from the meat that they're eating, kind of the opposite of what you're saying. And that's perhaps the thing that's allowed the rise of industrial agriculture and the, you know, practices that are really quite horrible to animals. How do you think we help people to feel more connected to the food that they're eating?
Maybe they should read Pig or come and see them. But I think that is, people either turn away altogether. They either sort of, close their eyes and eat whatever meat from whatever system it's come from. They just don't think about it. Or they, some people just say, I don't want to eat meat at all. They reject the system. I think that one of the reasons why the Soil Association has been so keen on our Food for Life program, actually getting kids growing stuff, keeping animals themselves. A lot of the schools we work with have their own chickens. One or two of them even have pigs. And so that kids actually grow up understanding that cycle of life. Because I think that is a crucial thing for us to understand at quite a fundamental level. If we don't understand the growth, the birth, growth, death cycle, I think we feel quite alienated in this world. If as a farm child, you grew up really cheek by jowl with that. And yet I think a lot of kids grow up not really understanding, probably being very frightened of death, actually, of the whole idea of death, and are quite haunted by that, rather than actually having the opportunity to look at it and to be part of it and understand that we're part of that natural cycle, and that in nature, everything eats everything else all of the time. That's what happens. So I think that we can do stuff in schools. We can encourage parents. I thought it was interesting somebody talking today about the fact that even if we're getting this more right in primary schools, our adolescents are just not getting any contact with nature at all. And it can't be contact with nature that is just a fluffy kind of, isn't it pretty, romantic thing. Actually, we need to get a bit, we need to have a deeper understanding of it than that, because that cycle of life is not all about a sort of fluffy, pretty landscape. It's about that cycle of life and death. And we need to feel, understand that we are part of that, and to feel not comfortable with it, but at least at peace with it.
So the name of this podcast is Stories That Matter. And so I was wondering if there's a story from your life or that you've heard, it can be real, it can be fiction, but something that's really influenced what you're doing now.
Oh goodness, that's one to put me on the spot with. I tell you one thing, and I don't know whether it's what you're looking for, but when I was a child, I think we often underrate children, the way we come into the world and where we see it so fresh. But I had a series of dreams when I was a kid, sort of these recurrent dreams, and one of them was I'm sort of wandering along, and I suddenly realised that the house is on fire. There's something desperately urgent that I need to go and do. I don't know what I'm going to do about it, but I know I need to get there and I need to do something about it. So I'm rushing off to go and sort out this fire or problem or whatever it is. And then I keep getting distracted along the way by people coming, oh, Helen, come and have a cup of tea or whatever it is. And I kind of wander off, and then suddenly, oh, bloody hell, get back. You've got to get to that. And it wasn't the only dream. There was two or three others that were also very, very formative for me. But that understanding that we need to understand the enormity of the situation, and we need to stay on the case. That it's so easy to be distracted by, it's not saying we could have any fun, because I can't live life without fun, but that we need to keep that clarity of vision about what it is we're trying to achieve. And we need to, as much as brilliance, we need grit and determination and perseverance actually to get there. So that's, you know, one of the things, I guess, that I've just tried to, you know, I've just tried to stay on the track and use whatever opportunities there are that come along to make some progress, even though at times it's very easy to get distracted.
Thanks for listening to Stories That Matter, the Hawkwood podcast. To find out more about Hawkwood, Seed Festival or the Soil Association, follow the links in our show notes. This episode was produced by Laura Bing, with music by Daisy Burt, playing an original composition, Berta.